Joining us in the studio today is Morgan Jones Phillips. So thanks for coming on the show. So how did you come up with the idea of doing the emergency monologues?
Well, when I first became a paramedic, I was seeing a lot of new things. It was all new, it was fresh, it was exciting, it was wild. And basically, I just felt like if I didn't write it down, I was going to forget and I was going to miss it. And I didn't want that to happen. So I sort of started writing just sort of point form notes just so I could remember what a story was about. I didn't think it was going to become a book. I didn't think it was becoming a play. I just started making notes for myself, really.
Okay. So it was your own personal sort of diary of your experience as a paramedic. And at what point did you decide, hey, this might be something that other people want to hear about?
Well, I started having like sort of a roster of a bunch of stories that people like to hear. I'd be at a party and people were like, oh, Morgan, tell about this one. Tell about that one. And there's this one particular day where I just finished telling a story in a bar with a friend, and another guy came over, and they were like, oh, you got to hear this. And he said, oh, no, I've already heard it. He says, but I'd pay $5 to hear that story again. And that's what made me think, like, oh, I wonder if anyone else would pay $5 to see it. And so I thought maybe I could make it into a play if I strung all these stories together.
Right. And did you have to run it by any of your coworkers or higher-ups before you decided to sort of go public with this stuff?
Well, let's see. There's probably two ways I should answer that. they found out about it pretty close to opening night. I got a call from a high superior, called me at home to ask what this was all about, what this show was. He was very nice about it. He basically just wanted to know, like, are you breaking patient confidentiality? And I said, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. I'm not divulging any information about patients at all. He said, are you wearing the Toronto EMS uniform? I said, I'm not. I have my own little mock-up fake uniform that I wear. And that was basically all he wanted to know. And as long as I stay within those parameters, so far, so good.
Great. You first performed it in 2008 at SummerWorks Festival. Had you workshopped it before that? Had you done any sort of preamble?
I wish I had. I'll tell you. I did one test run where my director assembled a bunch of friends in her backyard. And so I did a show for 20 of her friends. We tried to have as many people that didn't know me personally already, just so they, you know, I mean, they knew her, but they wouldn't be ambulance people, right? They weren't paramedics. They were just regular theater people. And I did it for them, and it went really well. And then two days later, I did it at SummerWorks.
Okay.
I'll tell you, I was terrified. I brought a spare uniform. I had an extra pair of underwear just in case I pooed myself.
Okay, well, hopefully you didn't have to use that, but we won't ask you that on the air here. Has it changed in the past year or so in terms of its content and how you deliver it?
Well, I've pulled off 10 stories, and I've added 10 new stories. Just sort of some of the weaker stories, some of the ones that don't really work. Sometimes also, like, you know, something's funny to me, and you realize that for an audience of non, you know, non-medical people, they don't think it's funny. Like, and I've had that too many times where I'd be at a party, you'd tell a story, and be like, don't you get it? She was dead already. And there's just silence. And you realize that, a lot of the public can't quite handle a lot of the stories. So I pulled a few out, added a few more.
Okay. I have the book right next to me here, and there's, you know, over 100 pages of text. So you can't fit all that into a performance, can you?
No, the way that I do it, I'm pretty proud of this, although it has its moments of weakness, is I've built a giant wheel, a giant roulette wheel. I call it the wheel of misfortune.
Right.
And I spin the wheel, and whatever stories come up on the wheel, that's a story I tell. So there's 45 or so stories on the wheel. I usually tell around 8, usually at a show. So the idea is that if you came back another time, if you brought a friend, you get a whole new show.
Right. So you know, from night to night, you could get 8 to 10 completely new stories,
yeah,
depending on the wheel of misfortune.
Yeah. So sometimes I get the weaker ones and I'm just like killing myself for having the system. And sometimes, you know, there's always a balance, right? There's always good stories. And there's always weaker stories. It always comes together. I think it makes a good show.
Right. So, I mean, being a paramedic, you've had to see some fairly disturbing scenarios. Did you find that writing it down helped you, I don't know, cope or deal with, understand, take in these all this material?
Well, the truth is I never went into it with that approach. I never went into it as a coping mechanism or
okay.
as a way of a catharsis or anything. Like, really, the stories that I wrote down were stories that I enjoyed, that I wanted to remember. You know, everyone deals with the trauma that we see in different ways. And for me personally, I don't want to relive it. And for me not to relive it means really not making a record of it, not documenting it, not a lot of the time I don't even tell people about it. I just sort of finish it and try and go on. And I'm not saying it's the best way. It doesn't work for everybody, obviously. Right. Like a lot of people need to get it out and they need to talk. I try to forget it happened and move on. So,
okay.
So the heavy stuff is generally not in the show, nor in the book, nor have I ever written it down even for myself.
Okay. Do your coworkers have different ways of coping? Do you find that it helps them to talk about some of the stuff or?
Oh yeah. I mean, everyone will have their own system, right? So we'll have, we'll have a fair number of bar nights where we go out together. We go out for breakfast together after night shifts.
Right.
We'll try and go out once a cycle. It's about once every 6 weeks to go out to meet mid shift. But most of that's just blowing off steam. Like there's not a lot of personal talk during that time.
Right. Okay.
Didn't really answer what you said, but anyway.
The program in the original 2008 performance had some rules of paramedicine
mm-hmm.
printed on it, and I have that list with me here. And I was just wanting you to go over some of the rules with me and perhaps elaborate on why you chose them. So the list has about just 20 rules here. So rule mm-hmm. number one is people die, and rule number two is you can't always change rule number one. So is that something that you find that people have a really hard time understanding? It sounds pretty simple, but...
Yeah, I mean, one of the big things, when you do this job, you go in thinking, you know, you're the paramedic, you're there to save lives or whatever, and you can't be. You have to understand that your skills, your training, that your treatment at that moment is just one small piece of a much bigger picture, and people die, and you can't always save them. And if you think you can, you're going to burn out, and you're going to get depressed, and you're going to... have a hard time doing that job, and you probably won't survive in the career at all. You just got to go into it knowing that you're going to lose people.
Okay. So we have another rule here. Air goes in, blood goes around, anything else is bad. So what is anything else?
That's basically like, you know, if your patient isn't breathing, that's bad. If the blood is not going all the way through their body but is exiting somewhere, that's bad. That's the thing to remember. Like when you start to panic and when everything starts to fall apart, you just fall back on, are they still breathing? And is their heart still beating? And if that heart is beating, is that blood moving around? And as long as they are, you can work with that.
Okay. Another one of my favorites is, if it's after midnight at a motor vehicle collision and nobody's drunk, there's someone missing.
Yeah. That's pretty common. We go to a lot of car accidents and, generally anything after midnight is alcohol related.
Right.
And some people crash and they run for it and some people crash and they stick around.
So if someone's missing, it's presumed they've just fled the scene.
The odds are one of the people is the driver, yeah. We've had a lot of times also, I've done car accidents where there'll be a guy sitting in the driver's seat, seat belted in, and you walk over to him and he'll say, I was the passenger. The driver just ran away.
Oh. All right. People who drink Listerine don't smell minty fresh. Perhaps not something you would expect.
Yeah. I work downtown. My station is at Church in Richmond. And so we deal with a lot of the homeless population of downtown. And Listerine is a very cheap alcohol. And so there's a lot of people who drink Listerine by the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we, and it starts to sweat out of your pores the way garlic does, you know. And so
yeah.
The whole body starts to smell of Listerine. And then when they throw up, it's not a minty fresh puke.
So when you pull up behind a car with the lights and sirens on, the car will behave in the most unpredictable way possible. So we'd expect people to just clear out of the way when an ambulance goes, when the sirens go on, but...
Oh, people do everything. People will slam on their brakes suddenly if you're right behind them. People will... If let's say that there's three lanes and the left lane is clear, they will pull from the right lane thinking they're being dutiful to pull into the left lane, you know, thus blocking it for me so I can't get out. People pull onto the shoulder on the highway when I'm trying to drive onto the shoulder. People do basically, they can do anything you can think of, and it's not what you're expecting them to do.
Right. So as part of your paramedic training, did you have a how to drive with the sirens on? training? Because it's a little bit different than what we learn in when we're getting our G1s and our G2s and our full licenses.
Yeah, the driving with lights and sirens is really something that happens on the job. Like we, before, I remember my very first day and I remember my very first call, and it was for a cyclist who got hit by a streetcar, and it came in as a high priority lights and sirens call. And I was in the station and I was all nervous, and my partner says to me, he says, okay, you know, what do you feel more nervous about, driving or attending? And I said, well, actually, I'm pretty nervous about driving. He said, okay, you drive first. He handed me the keys. Wow. And that's how you learn, is with your partner sitting beside you, coaching you through it. Okay, drive a little faster here. No, slow down there. No, make sure you stop at the red light and then go through it. Never drive in oncoming traffic when you can see a car coming at you. Now, you pretty well, that's unfortunately one of the on-the-job skills you learn.
Hmm. Interesting. People who threaten to leave the Emerge unless they get seen soon will have their charts moved to the bottom of the pile.
It always amazes me in the hospital, people who first get upset that other people are being seen before them if they're sicker than them, and then think that if they threaten to go home, that means a nurse will care more. So yeah, usually if you threaten to go home, you'll end up waiting a little bit longer because they'll hope that you go home.
So drunks who stand on their own will want to fight you when you help them up. Have you had personal experience in that department?
I've had too many personal experiences in that department. The good news is that most drunks fight in slow motion, and they're quite manageable that way.
Okay, great. And finally, people with a minor problem will get irate about other people clogging the emergency department.
Yeah. Yeah, as I said, it amazes me when people will get very upset about people who come in for nothing, and you ask what they're for, and they'll say, oh, well, I've had this problem for 3 days, and I thought maybe I should get it checked out now.
All right. So those are some of the rules of paramedicine outlined in the emergency monologues. And before I let you go, Morgan, I was wondering if you could read us one of your monologues. My personal favorite when I saw the show was Code 5 equals very, very, very dead.
Sure.
This is as performed sort of in the 2008 Summer Works and 2009 Fringe Festival.
Sure. Code 5. Code 5 is the word that we use for someone who is very, very, very dead. Mostly dead, that's workable. Mostly dead, we can manage. Very, very, very dead means that they're beyond help. That's where you walk into the room, you look at them, and you can tell from afar that they're very dead. In these situations, there's nothing you can do for them. You don't disturb the body. Potentially it's a crime scene because you don't know how they died. So you basically leave things alone. There's a few criteria for us to know how it is that someone's dead. One of them is if they are decapitated, if their head is separated from their body, that's generally a sign that they're not going to get any better. If you can try to screw the head on all you want, it's probably not going to help. If you find yourself in a situation where you're doing CPR on one side and your friend is giving the oxygen across the room, the odds are that patient's not going to get any better. Transection, same story. If the top half of your body goes one direction, the bottom half of your body goes the other, very hard to fix. Rigor mortis, that would be where the word stiff comes from. If a patient is stiff and rock hard, it's very hard to do CPR on them because they are solid. Dependent lividity. This is one that this will enhance your CSI watching. This is where when someone dies, depending on the position that they die in, their blood starts to pool and as it's not being circulated, and it creates a purplish sort of bruising color. And so whatever is lowest to the ground gravity-wise will get this purple bruising, and you can see how long someone has been dead by measuring just how thick and how deep that purple bruising is. You'll see it in CSI all the time. You're going to love it. And the last one is exposed to brain matter. That would be your gunshots, your subway accidents, your car accidents, falls from extreme heights. Basically, if somebody has parts of their brain and you can see it, the odds are they're not coming back. Paramedics generally, we love code fives because they're low stress calls. Patient doesn't get any worse. They're as sick as they're ever going to get. And it's awkward at first sitting around in a room with a dead body, but get used to it.
Great. Everyone, you know, at a party or any sort of social situation will ask you what's the worst thing you've ever heard. And I'm going to not burden you with that question because our listeners will have to see an upcoming show or purchase a copy of the book to know what the worst thing that you've ever seen is. But I want to know what goes through your mind when somebody asks you at a party what's the worst thing that you've ever heard? What are you thinking when somebody asks you that question?
Well, when they ask me that, like, I know what they're asking. But the truth is that the worst thing I've ever seen is something that they don't want to know about, and something that I don't want to think about, and I don't want to relive it. So I always have sort of a brief moment where I think about it. And then every paramedic will have their own set answer, right? Like, they'll say they'll say something different. Like, some medics will say, oh, the worst thing I've ever seen, I'll tell you. It was that time back in the station, I walked into the washroom, my partner was coming out of the shower, and his towel fell down, and it was awful. Like, or they'll say something. For me, when someone asks that, I usually say paper cuts, man. Paper cuts are the worst. but yeah, usually obviously, like, you will never hear the worst thing that a medic has ever seen, because it's not something they want to talk about, and it's not something you want to hear.
Okay, great. If you want to hear and read more of Morgan Jones Phillips' emergency monologues, then you can pick up a copy at the Wise Daughters Bookstore. That's 3079 Dundas Street West in Toronto.
There's always more information. You can check out if I have a show coming up at emergencymonologues.com, my website. It'll keep you posted on what's going on.
A trip on a bus that I didn't know. Met a girl selling drinks at the disco. That truth comes back when you let it go. Seems complicated cause it's really so simple. Walking down Young Street on a Friday. Can't follow them, gotta do it my way. No fast lane, still on the highway. Moving in and out, no doubt there's a bright day. No time to get down cause I'm moving.
Shake off the crabs in the bucket.